Cedric Mohammed.
And even today, there do appear to be two Russias, one characterized by a thuggish police state that uses its oil wealth to wield power, stifle civil society, democracy, and a free press. The other is the Russia of younger people, more modern, connected to the world, aware of global trends, and perhaps hoping that Russia will participate in them more fully. In a way, these two pictures of Russia have been around for a while. 150 years ago, a furious debate erupted among Russian intellectuals. On the one hand, there were the Slavophiles, who believed Russia was unique, different from the West, and would evolve on its own path. On the other side were the Westernizers, who believed that Russia needed to catch up with modernity, and this meant learning from and cooperating with the West. In the last few years, the insular, closed Russia has dominated the scene. But could a new, more modern, more cooperative Russia be emerging? One reason some people have some hope is that the new president of Russia talks in tones quite different from those of Vladimir Putin, the prime minister, who most believe is the true...
That would be Vladimir Putin, the Don, gangster of the year.
...ruler of the country. Just last week, a day before I met with him, Medvedev penned an extraordinary article for a Russian website. It was a frontal critique of Russia today, its oil-based economy, its bad business habits, its corruption, and its unhealthy civil society. Now, does this mean Medvedev intends to genuinely reform Russia? Can he? Does he have any power anyway? Well, listen in. President Medvedev, thank you again for joining us. I have read the Constitution, and I understand the division
of
Russian Constitution. And I understand the division of roles between the president and the prime minister. And my understanding, reading it on paper, is the president is the superior office. And so my question to you is, are you Vladimir Putin's boss?
Would be upset if you didn't ask me this question. Our interview in this case would be considered as a failure. Under the Constitution, in this country, there is one commander-in-chief, there is only one guarantor of the Constitution, the head of state. And that's the president of the country whom you are now talking to.
You know why I'm asking you this, Mr. President, because lots of people say Dmitry Medvedev is a very fine lawyer, he sounds like a reformist, he says all these things about what need to happen in Russia, except he has no power. All the power is held by Prime Minister Putin, so he is the ceremonial facade. It doesn't really matter what he thinks. What do you say to them?
As for the rest of it, well, it's even useless talking about this. In our country, where there's so much red tape, nobody can even lift a finger without me signing a paper first. Even if they have different opinions about who's in charge, that's an absolutely clear thing for anyone who wants to sort out this issue. But those who believe in those stereotypes, let them do it. Sometimes people prefer to perceive things according to those stigmas.
But you're saying that nothing happens without your signature, so in fact, you are making all the decisions, certainly with regard to foreign policy and...
It's even strange to hear you saying that, foreign policy. Only one man does it in this country, the president. You can see it everywhere. I'm on foreign business trips all the time. Naturally, all the directives, all the decisions.
This is a replay of Fareed Zakaria's interview of President Medvedev of Russia. Listen to how skillful this man answers these questions. Cold War, I don't even want to call it the Cold War, but America's not done with Russia. There will be problems in the future.
Adopted by the president. All the decisions which require discussion are adopted by the Security Council, but again, they are signed by the president.
Do you think you are more liberal than Vladimir Putin?
That's a good question. Vladimir Putin, when he met with his colleagues and with political analysts, he told me that he and I have the same blood. If you understand my blood, our education, then yes, that's the case. And I want you to know, I'm sure you know about this already. I want our readers and TV viewers to know about that too. Putin has a degree in law. He was not raised in the KGB or intelligence. He graduated from one of the country's best universities. Therefore, we are close in our convictions. Now, when talking about some nuances and preferences, yes, clearly there could be differences. I have my own views, he has his own views. For 8 years, he's been implementing his views quite successfully. There are no two identical persons in the world, no two identical leaders.
You think you're doing a good job as president? Right?
It's not for me to judge to the full extent whether I have succeeded in doing something or not. Though there are some objective indicators that exist, yes.
But if you are doing a good job, it would make perfect sense for you to run again in 2012, correct?
Yes, certainly if the conditions are right. Why not?
Let me ask you about U.S.-Russian relations. What do you think of President Obama? You've spent a fair amount of time with him?
I like to communicate with President Obama. We held a very serious meeting with him during his visit to Russia. I calculated that we had spent 8 hours together. That's quite a lot of time for such type of contact. Very often the talks between the presidents include official ceremonies, lunches, last for two and a half hours, as it was, in fact, the case with our American colleagues previously. This time around, we talked for 8 hours. And I'm thankful to my colleague for the fact that he wants to sort out many problems. That's important. He has another good quality. He listens to your arguments. He formulates his position, which may not necessarily coincide with the Russian position. But at least this is a result of a thought-out policy, thought-out approach as to what is useful or not useful to the United States of America. In that sense, it's comfortable to deal with him. But what people expect from us is results, not just good joint time spent together, although that is important.
But does it help that you're the same generation, that you're about the same age?
I think so. We're not just of the same generation, but also of a similar education. I mentioned it to President Obama.
I had to stop, because Mr. Medvedev is bearing witness to what I was saying earlier. He relates to President Obama. He's giving the credit to their educational background. But what is it about Barack Obama, what's universal, that the president of Russia would indicate some type of kinship with him? I mean, this is deeper than left-right. That's what I'm saying. You got to look at Obama, you have to look outside of the lens of American politics. You can't properly grasp the phenomenon of Barack Obama with left and right political ideology. Are you kidding me? But what Medvedev just said is revealing his assessment of Obama and what he thinks they share.
When we had our first meeting, that when he was at the helm of Yale Law Review, if I'm not mistaken, Harvard, or is it Yale?
Harvard,
okay. That's as good.
He went to Harvard Law School, yeah.
Anyway, I read both the Harvard and the Yale Law Reviews when I was a postgraduate student myself. So it's also important, you know, we'll see. What really matters here is that we try and hear each other.
What strikes one about an interview with President Medvedev, and what struck me about those answers was, first, he's a very bright, articulate man. He knows his mind. He speaks and thinks fast on his feet. He understands English, by the way. He did not use the earpiece for simultaneous translation throughout the interview. He understood all my questions and spoke to me before and after the interview in English, but clearly does not trust that in a formal interview he will say exactly what he wants to say in English. He bristled at the suggestion that he was not in charge, though most Russia experts do believe that Prime Minister Putin wields all the power. And he was very positively inclined towards President Obama. All in all, a good start. Then we went on to Iran and Israel and the possibility of war in the Middle East.
Russia has said that it does not want Iran to develop nuclear weapons. The Prime Minister Putin has said that, you have said that. Yet the International Atomic Energy Agency says Iran is not cooperating to give the world confidence that it has a purely civilian program. Iran says it will no longer negotiate on this issue. And yet, Russia says it will not support any further sanctions against Iran. So is the policy of not wanting Iran to develop nuclear weapons on Russia's part, are these empty words, or do you have concrete steps you are willing to take to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons?
We have our own very developed relations with Iran. I truly believe that Iran needs a system of motives, of incentives with regards to its nuclear problem. No doubt about that. On September 9th, Iran has transferred their proposals dedicated to these most complex issues, and currently they are being analyzed. Some people are already saying that is not enough, that those proposals are too generic. You know, I believe it is the duty of all countries involved in this matter to at least study these proposals.
Is Russia willing to step up to its responsibilities as a world power and press in the United Nations and in other ways to ensure that Iran does cooperate?
Iran must cooperate with IAEA, that's for sure, if they want to develop their nuclear energy program. It is their duty, not a choice. Otherwise, indeed, the question will always be asked, what are they up to after all?
A little taste there, the Russian president. Russia still wants their sphere of influence. Let me get to this interesting article. Why drug dealers are the perfect gurus in a recession. Now, I still haven't picked up my copy of the 50th Law. 50 Cent with Robert Greene, but Lucy Kellaway, who writes the On Work column for the Financial Times on Monday, she had an article, Why Drug Dealers Are the Perfect Gurus in a Recession. Let me give you, I think this will work out well, because not everybody catches every show. Let me give you a little bit of 50 Cent on CNBC with Robert Greene from a couple weeks ago, and then I'll read this.
How did you guys hook up? How did Robert Greene, you and I talked years ago.
You were my very first interview, and I'll never forget it.
No way. Are you kidding me?
He was so gentle.
He told me you scared him.
Yeah, he was very reassuring.
I did a book. And in fact, you read that book.
Yes.
And you were impressed, and you said, let's do a book together, right?
Absolutely. That 48 Laws of Power, 33 Strategies of War, Art of Seduction.
Yeah.
A lot of people in hip-hop really like the 48 Laws of Power because the music industry has to be perhaps the most Machiavellian environment that there is. And they found the advice very helpful. So 50, he contacted me. And we thought it'd be really interesting to do a book together because we come from such different backgrounds, but we have a sort of a similar way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So this is the monster that we created together.
And I love the 50th law, fear nothing. I see you laughing. Nihil temendum est.
Good pronunciation.
They did Latin back.
So what was the message that you wanted to get out that you felt Robert Greene could help you with?
Well, just his laws and the 48 laws of power, the short of the law was translating completely different. Like people who didn't actually see the significance in the research just read the short and said, okay, I understand how this applies to the actual environment. And they took that on. Like a lot of people that would make reference to Robert's first book would just make reference to the small portion of the actual law. And then it was exciting to see that I had some of the, I thought like some of these great people. Mm-hmm. You know, so to get a chance to collaborate with him and just to tell him my other thoughts and some of my experiences and have him write it from those perspectives after researching these other people, I thought it would be, you know, great.
So who's going to read this book? People who listen to your music or people who read your books?
Hopefully both.
Both.
We want both. We want everyone.
And the people who haven't had an opportunity to read his books. We want to make it bigger than life.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're living through times where people are very frightened. You know, they're very scared. And the message of the book is you need to move past that fear because in a couple of years or maybe less, this recession is going to be over.
Right.
And are you in a position to seize the moment, and I think it's going to be a new entrepreneurial era, or are you just waiting on some job?
I think the majority of the companies on the Fortune 500 were actually established during a recession.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's when opportunity presents itself, right?
Now, it's almost the definition of a recession when people are scared. I mean, to me, a recession is when people want to wait and see because they're too scared.
Yes.
And definition of recovery is when people want to do it now because, you know, they fear nothing and they're going to get going.
And so a recession is predominantly for middle class, you know, because where I come from, the majority of those people have always lived in a recession.
That's part of the point of the make that you make in the book, Fear Nothing. Your mother was murdered when you were so young. Yeah. Your story is so, so sad on one level as a child, and yet here you are. Your point, one of your points is, don't let fear get in your way because you can make it.
Well, I've had situations like you just pointed out that were so extreme to me in the earlier point that it makes me go into these situations without fear.
Sure.
You know, because I've already experienced the worst possible
scenario. What else could you lose?
Yeah.
And a lot of people think that his lack of fear is just the aggression and all that. But when you were talking about the video piracy and all that, he's really open to change and anything that's going on in the world. He just sort of embraces it and moves with it, which to me is sort of the epitome of being fearless.
You know what I'm also struck by? We talked about this in our production meeting this morning. Back in the day, when the Rolling Stones, for example, to use them as an example, were coming up, you know, they were the rebels, they were the mavericks. As you would portray yourself, that would be your brand as well. But they really shunned business, per se. That would be selling out to be involved in business. Your generation of music performers really embrace business, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, well, it is a significance to having the ability to be a part of these projects. It's the interest that you generate through popularity in music will allow you, you know, opportunities to be, you know, the face of actual companies, that major corporations that, like, I've done my own shoe with Reebok. You know, that this is something that was completely reserved for professional athletes, you know, prior to myself and Sean Carter, you know.
You watch CNBC, I assume,
you're
a big stock market investor, right? How's the stock market been treating you, and you're still trying to sell that big property out in Connecticut?
Yeah, I'm still trying to get rid of the elephant. Big white one, you know. You know, real estate would be the safest place to put your money prior to the.
So they told you.
Yeah,
right?
That's what they told me. I need I need advice.
Get out of my cars.
But I mean, you still got the $100 million from the water deal.
You know,
it's put in the stock market. I hope not.
I live pretty moderate.
Where did
you put
it?
Not extreme.
He put it into some new venture. He's always reinvesting. He's always got some new hustle up his sleeve.
I ain't scared. That's what the book
is
about.
He doesn't stay put.
But you also live below your means. That's an important aspect, right?
Yeah,
don't get over-leveraged.
Yeah, I don't want to be overexcited. I have a great opportunity. I have great examples in front of me, presented to me without anyone speaking to me. Every morning I wake up in a home where Mike Tyson previously laid in the bed, and he earned over $500 million in his career. You know,
where
so
is it?
It makes me conscious.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know what? You're a great guy. We enjoyed having you. It was a thrill meeting you, and we wish you well with the book and all the other ventures you got coming out as well.
Thank you.
Great to see you. Fiddy Cent with us today with Robert Greene, co-author of the book, The 50th Law, and that was a lot of fun.
The introduction to my new book starts with 50 Cent. I begin my book using 50 Cent as an example of something. October 7th, The Entrepreneurial Secret. I got it right here. My hands, 3-volume book series on entrepreneurship. Now let me read the Financial Times article. I just tweeted it out, if you didn't have it already. At the age of 12, Lucy Kellaway writes, he was a drug dealer. At 22, he had 9 bullets shot into him at close range. At 23, he had a career change and became a rapper. By 30, he had diversified into clothes, vitamin, mineral water, and condoms. And now at 32, he has pulled off something that Jack Welch didn't manage until he was 30 years older. 50 Cent is now a management guru. For the rapper, this latest career move has come early, but for the management guru industry, it is long overdue. Mountaineers, conductors, and army generals have all stepped forward to offer their tips for success to managers. But as far as I know, 50, as his fans know him, is the first hustler to give a helping hand to executives on their way to the corner office. Drug dealing has considerably more overlap with business than playing the violin or climbing a mountain. It's a competitive, fast-growing industry in which the success will have to be even sharper and more flexible than the most driven businessman. To quote from 50s in the club, I'm fully focused, man. My mind, I can't do this. Oh, man. Lucy Kellaway, if you all could see a picture of her, Lucy Kellaway, the columnist for the Financial Times, is quoting 50 Cent in the club, and I can't keep a straight face. I'm struggling. She says, to quote from 50s in the club, I'm fully focused, man. My money on my mind. Got to mill out the deal, and I'm still on the grind. I gotta put a picture of Lucy Kellaway up for you to get the full, you know what I mean? In order to repackage this message for an audience who do not wear their trousers around their ankles, 50 has teamed up with the writer Robert Greene, who has a fine pedigree in plundering management tips from such bad boys as Hannibal, Sun Tzu, and Machiavelli. The result of their collaboration is a book called The 50 of Law, written by Greene, but in which 50 is given the odd quote, quote, the greatest fear people have is of being themselves, he says. You are running away from the one thing that you own, which makes you different. This is, and by the way, I like that, by the way, what 50 just said there. But she says, this is both disappointingly unoriginal and plain wrong. I don't know about 50, she writes, but being myself doesn't even register on my list of big fears. These include getting knocked off my bicycle, failing badly at something, and a fish brushing against me when I'm swimming. And while I've never lost a second sleep over being myself, it wouldn't be a bad thing if I had. When I am myself, I'm sloppy, bad-tempered, etc. Fear might make me get my act together more. When he was younger, 50 was taken to one side by a wise old hustler charmingly named Truth, and told that the greatest danger a dealer faces is that his mind goes soft and his eyes wanders from the streets. Truth never has said a truer word. This is what appears to have happened to 50 himself. He's gone soft. His management thesis seems to boil down to a plea for authenticity, which is an old idea and a soppy one at that. Damn, this Lucy Kellaway is tough, y'all. Financial Times. She says, it is all such a missed opportunity. I have an acquaintance who for decades was a loyal customer of drug dealers in London and the United States. In the process, he learned a prodigious amount about the business. It is only a pity that he all but destroyed his life in the process. He explained to me that drug dealers are the perfect gurus for a recession or credit crunch. They live permanently in a world of zero credit. If you are a hustler, you can't go and see your bank manager and get a loan. So the best ones are virtuosos at managing cash flow. The next thing they have to teach the CEO is ruthlessness. The drug dealer must not rip off his client. He must supply him with good product, but beyond that, will show a total disregard for his welfare. Any CEO who has to make half the workforce redundant needs to feel a similar detachment. A third area of leadership is through jargon. The drug dealer goes beyond the CEO in inventing words from scratch. Quote, I've got the real pain. But both groups share a keen interest in flouting the laws of grammar. CEOs like to make a noun a verb, as in to action, while drug dealers stray still further from the rule book and put words in the wrong order. Soon come, they say. Neither group feels any need to make what they say true. Just as the CEO doesn't mean it when he says integrity is in our DNA, the drug dealer who says soon come actually means the client will be left twiddling his thumbs on the street corner for an awfully long time. With cars, the dealers have also been trendsetters. For years, they have favored blacked-out windows, a trend slavishly copied last year by bankers as they race to the Treasury for secret appointments. And listen, let me something about 50's interview I wanted to say. And this is what I don't... Well, I really like 50 and Jay, what they represent as hip-hoppreneurs in my view. I don't like how they take the gospel of frugal living, saving their money. They take that on CNBC, but they won't say that on BET. On BET and MTV, it's all about how much they're spending conspicuously, while on CNBC, 50 says, I live moderately. That's all. My only little gripe, 50. I'm going to get your book, though, brother, because I believe in supporting true greatness. So it says, self-respecting CEOs now change their vehicles almost as often as drug dealers and are also aping the hustler's taste in bling and in lawlessness. The conspicuous consumption that came out in the Dennis Kozlowski and Conrad Black trials would surely have made Truth and 50 quite proud. A further similarity is that neither tend to consume the products they sell. Although CEOs must pretend to do so or they get in trouble, as Gerald Ratner once did when he said his jewelry was crap. However, in an emergency, a drug dealer must be able to pop his product in his mouth and swallow it at a moment's notice, whereas the CEO seldom finds call for such extreme action. The final parallel between the two professions is the revolving door at the top. CEOs and hustlers tend to get found out, and both often end up with a bullet in the head, the only difference being that in the dealer's case, the bullet is the real pain. Any comments on that, let me know. Rod Ginyer, Culver City, California, he's letting me know. He has his brother from another mother with him, a gentleman by the name of O.C., very knowledgeable about the reparations movement and is a griot in his own right. He says, I may have another loyal listener, and I might add that he probably won't be following anyone on Twitter either. Well, I have love for anyone who is in any way affiliated with the Chosen One, Rod from California, much less someone who's involved with the reparations movement. I do need an Indaba reparations movement update. And is the reparations movement in New York rallying around Brother Gaddafi's presence? But I want to welcome OC to the hottest show in the diaspora. It just so happens I've got some jazz playing. Usually Rod Ginyer can call, he can pick out what I'm playing. I don't even, he's got like a 75% success rate. Rod, what is this? Usually he'll get it. Some of my careful jazz listeners. So that was 50 Cent and Robert Greene. If anyone has the book, The 50th Law, let me know if you like it. I'm going to go cop it. And my book starts out speaking on 50 Cent. The Entrepreneurial Secret is my book, and 50 is prominent. Hope nobody minds jazz. All my hip-hop aficionados. Next hour, we're going to review the new album from Sean Kingston tomorrow. I just want to make one point about Sean Kingston. And I want to see if some of the, a certain category of my listener bears witness to me. Is it truth that I'll be dropping? Brick City, any more comments? If you're watching Brick City, the documentary, let me know. If you like or don't like, I'll drop my 2 cents on that. What hourly intro can I drop for hour number 5? Already hour number 5, y'all. Well, there's a, I have a good friend who is not shy or threatened. We were speaking earlier about subordination and how it is an important business principle. Women are the masters of it. They know how to make you feel good in a way that lowers their profile, I'll say. They don't see women, when they do it for a male, they don't see that as oppressive, a lot of women. It's called subordination. If you can master that skill, you can get what you want. My mother has perfected that with my dad. I mean, it's total domination through subordination, which is really total control, if you understand it. I'm gonna have some women come on the show and drop knowledge on the teachings of subordination. Women have a hard time doing that for other women, though. Now, that's you're opening up a whole new scenario. But Ed McMahon was the ultimate subordinate for Johnny Carson, and it allowed him to be a multimillionaire at one point. And when he passed away, or when the show was ending, rather, because Johnny, I think, went first, he teared up talking about his subordinate. I don't mind heaping praise on greatness wherever I see it. I don't really even care what color it's in. We got to get better at that. Start rooting and cheering for one another. Even if you don't think you have something to offer, you may have a kind word, and just your enthusiastic interest in what a person is doing could maybe give them a lift. Cedric Muhammad.